Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, a Bloomberg economics model that projects the probability of a U.S. recession in the next 12 months is now at 100%. After the jobs data, though, over the last couple of weeks, you could have said that that much was clear. So how should you actually invest through an economic recession? Our guest will break it all down.
That's right, Sarah. And of course, we'll close the episode with the craziest thing we saw in markets this week. And Sarah, before we get into all that, I would love an update on your situation. I know you made a mad dash escape from New York. Tell us exactly what you did. You drove all the way to Florida, is that right?
I did. So I decided I had been self-quarantining in New York for quite a while, for over 2 weeks. So I decided to try to make the great escape. So I did the drive all in one day. I didn't want to go through an airport. So Saturday, 17 hours, woke up bright and early. We drove all the way down to South Florida. We had to stop for gas a couple of times. Of course, had masks, gloves in certain areas that were a little bit more remote. I think people were looking at us like we were insane. It looked like there weren't many people around, but they were going on with their lives as usual. And there we are, Cloroxing the entire gas station. but made it down, and other than stopping at gas stations, didn't make a single stop. So now I have to self-quarantine by law in Florida, so I'm quarantining for 14 days here, but I'm at least happy to have more space than my New York apartment.
So how does that work? They stopped you at the state line because of the...
Yeah, so at the Florida-Georgia border, wasn't backed up at all. Didn't have to go through any traffic or wait or anything like that, but I had to go through a checkpoint. So essentially, you drive through... They ask you where you're traveling from. I told them I was coming from New York. So then they make you circle back around to a different checkpoint area where they make you fill out a form. You have to give them your contact information, where you will be self-quarantining in case they want to check in on you. And you have to sign a form saying that you are aware that by Florida law, if you break the quarantine, you can be subject to a fine or up to 60 days in jail. So I am quarantining.
You know, I think, Sarah, you realized that my dad instincts were kicking in on this trip, and I was very worried about you making it down. So you did tell me when you arrived safely. I appreciate that.
As soon as I arrived, I let you know.
I was worried about that trip, but glad to hear you're safe and sound.
Thanks, Mike.
In quarantine. And I think our guest is in quarantine not far from me here in New Jersey, where we're basically all in quarantine. But we're very welcome to have her return to the show. She is an investment strategist at Edward Jones. Her name is Neela Richardson. Neela, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be with you both.
And how are you surviving the quarantine? Is the family behaving, and are you have enough supplies?
You know, supplies have changed definition. We have enough of what we need, and the family's doing well. Thanks for asking me. I have two teenage boys, and so the question is not keeping them entertained. It's getting them to talk to you on a regular basis. And so, you know, every so often I just check in their rooms, make sure they're still functioning and they're doing quite well. They don't seem to be missing school as much as I imagined that they would be.
Well, now they have plenty of time to find time to speak with you and the family.
That's right.
So
that's right. We're breaking,
can't avoid
out,
it.
Breaking out the board games and the puzzles. So plenty to do.
Well, hey, I have teenage girls. So when I hear that teenage boys are quarantined, I'm happy about that. I hope that continues past the virus.
Dad instincts kicking in.
But Neil, I'm curious, you know, as an investment strategist, how do you do your job these days? You must be getting a lot of calls, a lot of people wondering, is the bottom in the market in? Is this a new bull market we're seeing, given all the stimulus that's going on? Like me, I'm sure your clients are throwing a million questions at you at once. So what are you saying when you answer the phone these days?
Well, you're right, Mike. We are talking to clients. Our outreach to clients and to financial advisors has amped up considerably over the course of the month. And that constant communication is critical, because what we're focused on is not just the markets, but the emotional reaction to the markets. And this is the time where the behavioral economics come into play. All those things that we warn about, that investors do, the mistakes investors make, this is the time where they make those mistakes, right? They try to time the bottom of the market. They try to sell at the peak, and along the way, they miss the rally, and we've seen the markets rally over the last few days here. So we're trying to both inform them at a market level, but also make sure that their behavioral reactions are not ones that make them derail their long-term goals, and that's quite a balance.
So given that, it's pretty certain, it's virtually 100% certain that we know that we are now in a recession. And sure, this time around, it could be completely unique considering the reasons why we have seen the economy react as it has due to a spreading viral outbreak. But can you maybe just walk us through how markets actually typically react through a recession span from start to the point in which you actually start seeing a recovery?
Well, as you know, this recession is quite different than what's typical. And if you think about the typical timeline of a expansion path, it's really affected by the path of inflation. We see that economies, they typically grow for a very long time. They become overheated. Consumer prices start to increase. And then there's this inflation threat that's an overhang. That's when the Fed comes with their butcher knives and tries to choke off this expansion by raising interest rates. We're not seeing anything like that right now. What we're seeing is an economy that's not broken, but has basically put itself into a medically induced coma in order to attack a disease. And that's, we've done that by social containment. And the real threat right now in terms of the economy is not inflation, it's deflation, and the fact that people can't work. And the economy is tackling a hit to both supply and demand. So the market reaction is actually following, I think, a traditional playbook. We're seeing that the markets typically lead a recession for a period of time. And in that sense, it's correct. Before we knew the extent of this downturn and before we saw those jobless claims, the market had already reacted. Now, the key difference is the market reacted really quickly. It typically takes about 9 months to see that drop from a record high all the way down to a bear market, that 20% decline. This bear market happened in 22 calendar days. I mean, the speed of the market reaction has been really unprecedented. And I think that's what's different, along with the composition of this expansion to recession timeline.
I think that's a great analogy, the medically induced coma, Neil. And I know you have an economics background. So what I think the big question I have, and maybe other people have, is that, okay, we take that patient out of that coma, you know, and quote unquote reopen the economy. I just can't help but wonder how long the headwinds to the economy last after that process, because I'm thinking, you know, it would be a while personally before I would be comfortable, say, going to a movie theater, going to a stadium, flying on a plane, going to a hotel, all of those things, until the vaccine comes, which is, you know, hypothetically, I guess, still probably at least a year out. So once we do, you know, quote unquote, reopen the economy, how strong do you think those headwinds will be as far as consumer behavior and getting back to that normal that we were in before the virus?
Well, I think there's a lot of uncertainty. I don't know about you, Mike and Sarah, but I want to break out of this house and go to a restaurant and a bar like nobody's business. So you might see a surge in economic activity. I would love to go to the mall and shop right now. I would. There are many things. I'm looking forward to the next Marvel movie and seeing it in a theater. So
you've got that Short Hills Mall near you. I can't blame you. That's a good mall.
It's the mall I was thinking of when I said it. So, I have to think that even these activities are going to be scaled down. Yes, maybe movie theaters will reopen, but they'll be at maybe 50% capacity instead of 100% capacity. There will still respect the 6 feet of distance between us, at least initially, until we get enough test kits and security that people are on the other side of a viral outbreak and that it won't lead to this huge community contagion that we've seen. And I think in terms of the market perspective, the market has done a fantastic job of pricing and I think a lot of bad news already. And that's why we can see this huge uptick in jobless claims and the market still rally on a weekly basis. But I don't think the market has done a very good job of pricing in a recovery or the timeline to that recovery. And I think that's the biggest risk. We're in a recession. We know it's going to be deep, but we don't know how quickly the economy gets back online. And that is the huge question mark.
You know, I have seen others say that it is possible that if we do get a reopening of the economy by, say, June, then the seasonal pickup that you see in the economy over the summer, you still might see that occur because you might see people wanting to go out and get out of the house and really take part in some of those activities or traveling, but it's yet to be seen. And Neela, something I've been thinking about is the idea that, okay, the leveling off that we have seen in some hotspots as it relates to coronavirus cases. Some investors have said that's been encouraging as it relates to the idea that maybe the economy can open sooner rather than later. But Peter Cicchini, one strategist, he pointed out to me and a colleague of mine that the reason that we're seeing this leveling off is the fact that social distancing and self-quarantining is in fact working. So do you ever think about or do you get worried about this possibility that until we do have a vaccine or science develops further, that this is maybe the only way to combat the spread of the virus, which means the economy won't be able to open wholly for quite a long period of time?
It is a concern. The medical progress will lead everything. You know, this is not a problem that the Fed can fix. And we saw that the Fed even this week has come out with even new kitchen sink approaches to ensuring the flow of liquidity. This is not a problem that just fiscal dollars alone to consumers can fix. So that will help turn in the economy. This is a problem that it takes medical ingenuity, progress and innovation. Now, that may not just rest on a vaccine. It could be expanded testing procedures or other things that that the medical community, with ample help from the Fed and state governments, can do to build confidence so that we can go outside and not feel threatened just going into a grocery store. And that's going to take some time, I think, to get over that psychology.
Thank you.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, you mentioned that kitchen sink approach from the Fed. Our columnist Cameron Kreis had a funny line saying, well, yeah, it's also the cupboards, the sideboard, and even a few paper plates and plastic cups they dredged up from a closet right. in the laundry room. I wonder, Neela, they clearly are doing everything under the sun to add liquidity to the market. I worry, though, if there's a little bit of improvisation and experimentation here going on. I feel like this quote-unquote whatever it takes approach is difficult for central bankers, at least in the U.S., and for the government to do when the recession is caused by sort of an endogenous financial system issue, like say the financial crisis. I think, you know, the public did not have a good taste in their mouth about a lot of those bank bailouts and the various programs that went on. In this case, it seems since, you know, it's this virus that was the fault of no human, as far as we know, this real exogenous shock to the economy that it's almost like it's freed the reins of the Fed and the government to basically really do whatever it takes. But once we get through this, I wonder where the risk is. And you had mentioned that the near term threat is deflation. Are we again going to be worrying about inflation at the other end of this? And I know people have been worried about inflation throughout the entire bull market that just finished. And the entire economic cycle. But is there any reason to believe that this time could be different, that this will be the potential for an inflationary shock once we're through, the economic slump that's being caused by the quarantines and the isolation? Is all this liquidity and money being thrown at this problem going to come back and bite us down the line?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm going to take that in parts. I'll start with your last statement on inflation. What's remarkable about this downturn is it's both a hit to demand and a hit to supply. Now, the global hit to demand we've seen and we understand, and that's what's deflationary. But what's inflationary is the global hit to supply. I think Sarah went to a couple of gas stations. I think gas stations are the mecca for the supply and demand shock illustration. Why?
I want to say that at one gas station we stopped out, we paid $1.78 a gallon.
Yep, there you go. There you go.
Was that the low of the...
That was the lowest that we saw.
We should have had you do a chart, a geographical chart of all your gas prices.
Everywhere we stopped, yeah. I mean, they were all very low, but yeah, a couple spots.
Remarkable. So there you go. There's the oil price shock, the slump in demand, and then the breakdown in OPEC talks recently. Hopefully that's improving soon, which led to the announcement of more supply. So that's it. But if you go into that gas station and try to buy a bottle of a pack of water, you might see $18 water for 24 bottles. So you're seeing some inflation in things like toilet paper and water and rice and basics. So if global demand rebounds, but we still have these supply shocks, you could see the dominance of slagging demand be outweighed by the dominance of the shock in supply, and that would be inflationary. And so there's a huge amount of uncertainty in terms of how this plays out into the recovery. And then just briefly, you asked, will we be paying for this somehow, this kitchen sink approach by the Fed and by fiscal government sometime down the road. Well, we already know that deficits were high, $1 trillion as far as the eye can see every year. Deficits are about to surge further, though, in the context of low interest rates. Economists are really concerned about incentives. And when you have a kitchen sink approach, you don't think a lot about incentives in doing that kind of legislation. And so that could be where the rubber meets the road. Are we changing behavior in unexpected ways by the way that we are trying to stimulate the economy in a time of crisis?
So I'd imagine, of course, the inflation outlook, which is a little bit muddied at this point in time, is something you have to take into account when thinking about how to position portfolios going forwards. But I also want to dive a little bit deeper into something you mentioned earlier in the show, was you feel like the market priced in the downturn relatively well, but hasn't been as good at pricing in a recovery. And it made me think of a chart that I received from Credit Suisse, where they've been looking at what they call fresh estimates, where they only take into account bottom-up company profit estimates that have been revised recently. And what they looked at and what they highlighted this week was that because of the falling E and multiple expansion that we've seen this week with the rally is the fact that we're actually at now a 19 times multiple matching the multiple from the February 19th high in the stock market. And it's been hard for me to wrap my mind around, but it makes me also think, do you get a sense that the market doesn't really care about 2020 earnings? The idea that, yeah, everyone knows this year is going to be really rough, particularly in the next two quarters as we get those results, and that instead investors and the market are looking forward to 2021, 2022, trying to envision what that rebound might look like?
I think Steph Curry said it best a couple of months ago. We should just forget 2020. That's what the markets want to do. They want to move past 2020 to 2021, and they're anxious to do that. And so, yes, I think a lot of this bad news is being dismissed. It's either already priced in or will be dismissed going forward. But it also shows a concern because this bear market rally may have further to fall once that economic news and earnings news comes in differently than the market projects. So eventually the market, as it looks to the future, which in my mind is 2021, it's going to be anchored by the reality of the present and still a slog to get through this year.
I'm glad you brought up Steph Curry. There was a great story in the Journal about how he found himself quarantined at home, and he didn't have a basketball hoop in his own driveway, so he had to order one online, and it took him like 5 hours to put together his own.
That's shocking. Hoop. I can't believe he didn't have his own basketball.
I know,
hoop.
Right? You know,
I envision every single NBA player having their own basketball court,
right, or so. A gym in the backyard.
I don't know. Maybe some of us just don't like working from home. Leave it at work. I say leave it in the gym, but.
You know, Neely, you made a very, I think, super important point earlier in the interview when you talked about that investor psychology. I know my own mentality about this virus shifted dramatically this week. I had an old colleague. I used to work at the Associated Press way back when, and an old colleague, Enoch Chastanin, guy was 51 years old, a marathon runner, one of the nicest people you'd ever meet, caught this bug and died from it. And it really sort of, it was like a gut punch to me. I'd kind of been dealing, like I deal with everything like this with bad jokes, you know, and it really kind of made my head spin when you start to get sort of people in your lives being affected by this rather than just watching it on the TV, watching it in the newspaper. And I'm curious about that, sort of the consumer confidence element of this, the investor psychology element of this. You know, when you go to that, when you're finally allowed out of your house and you go to that Short Hills Mall, and Sarah, I don't know if you're familiar with the Short Hills Mall. It's the only mall I know that has, you can take a helicopter to.
What?
Yeah.
That's a thing.
Yeah.
Exists.
We'll have to fly you out there sometime. Neil is going to get her helicopter and pick you up, and we'll go shopping when this is all done.
I'm going to take you both
if
on
my helicopter looks like a 10-year-old Volvo, don't be surprised.
But I wonder, you know, that first trip through the mall, how much are people's psychologies going to be affected for years to come? You know, are you going to be doing more window shopping than actual spending at the mall? And, you know, how does that work in the investment landscape too? Are people going to be risk adverse or more risk averse than they were for quite a while at the back end of this, in your opinion?
Well, first of all, Mike, I'm really sorry for your loss, and I'm really sorry for all of these tragic stories that I've heard and that people are being touched with. I think this will be with us for a while. When you think about other tragedies, you think about 9/11, it does change how you view things, and it changes how you operate. You think of those 9/11 changes in New York and Washington, D.C., where I was living at the time. It was profound, the changes at the time that happened as a result of the tragedy. But over time, you kind of got used to them, and those changes began to blend into the background. And I expect that there will be changes made this time around. We will be different. We will shop different. We will approach crowds differently. It's going to feel strange, but over time, it's going to be business as usual, and those changes will fade into the background. Now, the markets, there's two inclinations. We saw them play out in March. First, it was the inclination to sell in panic. Sell whatever you can get your hands on, and that was the most liquid assets, and you saw that really play out in the bond markets. But there's this other impulse, which is to buy. Buy now. It's FOMO, fear of missing out. So you have these two twin dramatic, extreme reactions, either to sell in mass or to buy in mass. And that's where investors can get caught up, because neither of those approaches makes sense if you're a retail long-term investor. It's always about the plan. It's the plan that takes the emotion out of investing. And it's going to be having a plan in place, rules in place, helped by local governments and federal leadership that makes people feel comfortable about resuming their normal economic activities.
Yeah, you know, there's been so many just heartbreaking stories out there. Mike, again, we're both so sorry for your loss, but I think we're all going to be a little bit appreciative over the fact that it's a 3-day weekend, and we can all hopefully get some rest and just take it all in. And Zoom with families over the weekend, if that's something we're all doing now.
We're doing it right now as we speak. So
we are.
So there you go. And hopefully no weirdos show up. I keep hearing these stories about people Zooming with their class or church group or something, and some random weirdo.
I think it's
random,
you know, it's
weirdos add normalcy to what is. It's nice to know that they haven't gone away.
All right. Well, speaking of random weirdos, I think that's our segue, Sarah.
That is. I was waiting for it.
We're no random weirdos. We're professional weirdos when it comes to the craziest things we've seen in markets this week. So
very well.
So, Sarah, what do you got?
So I'm just going to bring it back to the kitchen sink that the Fed has now given us, because it really is just pretty crazy. On Thursday, when they made the announcement of more stimulus that they would provide, the fact that they are now buying U.S. high-yield corporate bonds. So the announcement reads, the preponderance of ETF holdings will be of ETFs whose primary investment objective is exposure to U.S. investment-grade corporate bonds, and the remainder will be in ETFs whose primary investment objective is exposure to U.S. high-yield corporate bonds. In a way, it's like, what's left now? Is it just stocks?
I mean, put the junk in the trunk.
That's pretty much all that's left. Yeah, the junk in the trunk. But it's crazy. It's pretty amazing.
And Neil, what do you think about that? This kind of goes back to what I was talking about, in that the potential risks, and I hate to trot out the old word moral hazard from this kitchen sink approach. I think clearly there's an urgent need for the Fed to do this in the junk market. Was this inevitable, and does it bother you at all?
I think what is being done to manage a crisis doesn't bother me, but the future does. We've seen the Fed having a lot of trouble prior to this pandemic unwinding the QE that it did as a result of 2008. Now they're just blowing up their balance sheet, and it's hard for me to imagine a world in which the Fed can comfortably unwind a lot of these assets. Now, many of them are short-term assets, and they will just roll off. But the Fed is going to be having this huge trillion-dollar portfolio, I think, for a decade or more, because it's been it hasn't been able to unwind successfully, even in the best of an economic expansion.
Yeah, I agree. It's once it's in, it's hard to take it out, I guess. So unless you, like you said, it rolls off, and you know, eventually a lot will roll off.
As we witnessed over the last decade.
Yeah. But all right, Neil, you're a veteran to the show, so I know you came prepared with the craziest thing you saw.
There's so many crazy things. It's hard to just choose one, but I'm going to stick with the bond markets, and I'm going to stick with this conversation about the Fed. The record level of investment grade corporate issuance that we saw this week is really outstanding. It's like the corporate market alternative to stockpiling toilet paper. It's just this run on credit while you can have it.
Like,
you have access now. You don't know what the future is. So let's just get as much as possible. And it seems that's what corporations are doing who have the investment grade rating. So interesting. It goes right back, Mike, to your insights about what's going to happen over the long term.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy with the toilet paper. It's amazing, though, that hunt for yield is still there, that the demand from investors is still there to allow this. I mean, I guess when the Fed is buying, you know, it goes back to why fight the Fed, but pretty fascinating phenomenons we're seeing. All right, Sarah, as you know, for the crazy things, sometimes I go to the alternative asset classes, and I'm going, and when I say alternative asset classes, I'm not kidding this time. I'm gonna take us to the exotic animal trade. And I'm assuming.
Are you gonna bring in some Tiger King right now? Or
you know it was coming. have you guys watched the Tiger King?
This is what I've been doing all quarantine long. Well, I guess not really, because I got through it in a matter of 2 days, but it's helped a couple days at least.
So, I think it was inevitable that eventually our president Donald Trump would somehow get involved in the Tiger King saga. I mean, that was pretty predictable that those two paths would collide. And now there are reports out there indicating that Trump is considering pardoning the Tiger King, Joe Exotic himself. And like I said, this is an alternative asset class, exotic animals. So it counts. I don't know if that guy from Hong Kong is going to call in and say I'm cheating again, but I'll stand by this one.
That you're cheating. Did either of you see at one of the press conferences, there was a reporter who asked President Trump about Tiger King and asked him if he would consider pardoning him, and there was a nice little back and forth.
That's some
comedic relief.
What do you guys think? It was a Joe Exotic pardon. Is that going to help Trump's re-election chances?
Having never seen the show, I'm not exactly sure what actions are being pardoned, but so I'll reserve judgment.
Well, you'll have to go watch it, Neela. It's pretty unbelievable.
I don't know. I think Neela's proven she might be the only one among us with some actual taste in television. That fact that she hasn't seen that.
Neela Richardson, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me. It's always a delight to talk with you both. And you take care, please.
You too.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is at Reganonymous, and you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.